You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking to Lisa Bulowski. Lisa, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd. It's nice to be here.
Lisa, there's so much work that you've done, different kinds of work, public work and printmaking and book work. What are you working on in your studio at the moment? If it's more than one project, just I'm interested to know.
Yeah, well, I always have had a practice that's pretty forked or split. And like you said, I work in temporary public and participatory projects, but also on very private projects and kind of gallery-based works on paper and installations. The projects that I'm working on now, one is participatory, and it's part of a project that I'm in a collective and working on. We're called 50-50 Art Collectives, and the project is Portable Memories in Rising Seas. And that's so far been based in Florida, in Key West and Miami. And I'm also working on a project in the studio that the big umbrella title for it or idea is called The Doubt of Being, and that involves sculptural works and an ongoing unbound book project that I'm really in the heart of the middle of working on right now, and some large-scale kind of tapestry pieces.
So I'd like to talk about both of those, Portable Memories and Doubt of Being. Let's start with Doubt of Being. It sounds like you're kind of immersed in that right now. And you said this involves a number of mediums, right? There's an unbound book that's being produced and a few other things that are also happening there in different mediums. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. The book is really what I've been working on recently. There's about, I don't know, 50 pages so far, and I have a feeling this will be something that never gets finished, as just the nature of it is, and the kind of tentative title, which is the Book of Eternal Returns, that comes from Nietzsche's idea of eternal recurrence, this kind of cyclical nature of time. And although I'm not sure I strictly believe in that, I think time is actually more kaleidoscopic. But I am looking at, and I've always worked with sort of rhyming images and ideas throughout history, and then the kind of disjunctive nature of time and images. So that the book is very much playing with those ideas, riffing a little bit on A.B. Warburg's Mnemosyne Atlas, and kind of pulling together different types of images from different aspects of culture and my own sketchbook.
Okay, so and this is all encompassing Doubt of Being. So, I mean, to get into some of those texts to see how you're approaching this, you mentioned Nietzsche and how you were parting from that a little bit. How also, I would like to talk a little bit about how Nietzsche was using that, or how you touched on that text, and also why the title, Doubt of Being, because that's, is that your own text, or is that referencing another book?
It is my own text, but so just to address the philosophical as a resource, I'm a bit of a dilettante, I would say. I'm not a heavy philosophy reader, but the questions that philosophy asks are a big part of how I approach my work. So I typically address my own thoughts and then research where those thoughts might have come up in other people's work. So I found the idea of eternal recurrence by first kind of speculating on what is the nature of time. My last body of work and exhibition was called Everything is Still Happening, which was a collage project that where I kind of worked from my own detritus in the studio to create new work. And so I found the Nietzsche reading based on my own investigations. And then the doubt of being is, it's an original phrase, but in doing that kind of reverse research, I found that Descartes, of course, who famously said, "I think, therefore I am," looked a lot at doubt and wrote about Cartesian doubt and found that even in doubting your own existence, that sense of doubt shows that you exist, the idea that you can doubt your own existence. So that cyclical or looping thought is a big part of this project, The Doubt of Being. But it's also about visibility. It's a kind of existential question of, am I here? Who is visible? What gets seen? What gets recognized? How do we see it or them? And what are the markers that signal where our attention will go?
And so this is, you know, that's so interesting. And in the book that you're making, the let's talk a little bit about that, the Unbound book, because that's, of course, a narrative experience and guides where the readers, the viewers' attention will go. How is that experience played out? Because, of course, there's a text, but how else is this book built to kind of guide the viewer's experience through this? And it is unbound, right? So is it in a box as
right.
well?
Well, see, this it remains to be seen since I'm still working on it. It is unbound. So, I mean, currently in my studio, it lives in a box, and I just keep adding to it. And so I haven't decided or settled on it. How it will be navigated. You know, a bound book gives that kind of guidance to the viewer and tells us what that narrative sequence should be. And I'm not interested necessarily in that for this book. I have made other books that are literally circular. I made some books on library rods, so the pages, you know, just keep going around. And so that idea interests me. But this project, I'm really constructing it in terms of spreads, so pairings or diptychs. And in a way, they are very much individual prints that could be paired up and hung on the wall in frames. But it seems important that the book form hold it and that it not go on the wall. So that remains to be worked out.
And what kind of imagery is in the book? There's your text, some of which we're already talking about, but what kind of imagery is in there?
There's photographic imagery. I'm trying to stay within the language of print. So even if there are collages, which there are, they are made from printed materials. So the things that are in the book range from photographic images, like there's a spread that has a photograph, the Nick Ut photograph from Vietnam of the girl running down the road after the napalm attack. And that would be one side of the spread. And the other side of the spread is a boy running from downtown Manhattan as the North Tower is falling. And they're incredibly symmetrical and rhyming images. So just juxtaposing those two is one aspect. And there are other photographic images in the book that are similar. There are pages that are from plates that I've buried in the ground over a sequence of days, letting the earth etch the plates and then printing them to show a kind of passage of time and resurrection, so to speak, and the mark that leaves. There are bits of text all through the book that are at current. They're not cited on the page. There will be an index that brings together all the quotes.
So that sounds really interesting. That's a very complex project. There's a lot that's that's happening there that that sounds like it relates to the text and back and forth. They're not. It sounds like they're not illustrative of the text, but in a way, we're talking about issues of time. It sounds like.
Exactly. Yes. Very much so.
So let's talk a little bit about the other project you mentioned at the beginning. Was it Portable Memories? Is that the title?
Right. Portable Memories in Rising Seas. Yeah, it's a project that Laurencia Strauss, who is the co-founder of the collective 5050, and an artist and landscape architect who works on socially engaged and environmentally activist works. And we paired our practices, mine on memory and looking at personal experience in relation to history and memory, and her practice, which looks at these vulnerabilities of people and the places that they inhabit. And we've been doing this project for a couple of years now. Let me try to briefly describe it.
Sure, it is a
Yeah, it's a participatory project. These are public events where we ask people to watch two short films. One is a short animation from 2008 called La Maison en Petticoupe. It's a Japanese animation about a man who drops his pipe down this hole in his house, and he goes swimming to get his pipe back and relives all these experiences of his life as the waters rise. The other is an excerpt from a film called Tuul Tuvalu, which is two locations, one in the South Pacific and one in Greenland, that are both being, you know, just imminently affected by sea level rise. And they're coping with that and needing to relocate. So as people are watching these films, we give them clipboards with scratch boards on them. That's the kind of black clay-coated surface that you scratch through to reveal a white surface underneath. And we just ask people to think about their connection to the place that they live and memories that they have in relation to that place. They can draw, they can doodle, they can write. We don't give any parameters on what they do. And then we collect those at the end of the screening and have some discussion about sea level rise and just sharing thoughts and feelings about what is happening to the places that people live. And then we've been taking the scratch boards and scanning them and working with the images that people have provided and enhancing them and bringing out really the salient points and changing them into large color posters that we use in exhibition circumstances. So we've shown it twice and done the project twice as an exhibition, once at the Miami-Dade Public Library and then also in Key West at the Sanger Gallery, which is part of the studios of Key West.
So there's a number of elements to that, and at that's exciting and clear the way you presented that. What is the very next thing to happen with that? Will there be a gathering or a show? What happens next? And because it sounds like that has so many legs to it, what is the next thing that'll be happening?
Yeah. It does have a lot of legs. I forgot to mention one of the aspects of it, which could be part of what happens next. We also take the scratch boards that people have made, and we laminate them, and then we take them out into the ocean, and we film them, showing them to fish underwater. So the idea is a bit absurdist, in a way, but it's also about sort of interspecies communication and leaving this legacy of images and memories to the creatures that will inhabit the space once the water rises. So that's a key aspect of the project and one that sort of has this long-term, outcome, hopefully. But we are currently looking for other locations to move this project to. We've had contacts with people in Long Island and Virginia and Boston and other places that we don't typically think of as being affected by rising seas. And we're thinking about even shifting to, like right now, here I'm in St. Louis, and the Midwest has incredible flooding right now and devastation due to the floods, which are said to be caused by climate change. So moving the project to places where people are not faced so much imminently by climate change or rising seas, but may have a connection to place and want to preserve those memories.
And so how would that happen? They want to preserve that memory. How would that move forward? In other words, you'd collaborate with them?
Right, just conduct additional participatory projects or events in other locations, such as St. Louis.
And so when you say we, who is we? We is you and several others, or different people that you work with?
We is myself and Laurencia Strauss as part of the 50/50 Art Collective.
And okay, so you were about to say so the next move into doing something like that, working with someone, is in a sense almost a commission process or a research process?
I would call it more of a research process. So maybe it would help to describe how we do this or did it in the Miami area. We had a public screening of the films and a participatory event at the library while the show was up. We had additional screenings and drawing sessions at the Miami Beach Senior Center and additional senior centers around the Miami area. So there's multiple events. They're like 1 to 2 hour events where people come to us or to their, we go to their location as well. We screen the films, we do the scratchboard project, and we have a discussion that takes about 1 to 2 hours. And then we collect those, like I said. So what we're imagining is that we just continue doing that in other locations, and then also each time the work gets exhibited, the new locations get added to the archive. And part of the project additionally is an archive book of all of the scratchboards that have been made, which so far is about, I think, 150.
That's very exciting. And so the last question before I ask you about what you're reading is, how is this funded? It's as a collaborative, is it off grants, or is the work bought and sold? How does a project as ambitious as what you're doing and multifaceted get funded?
We have received some grant money. I received a grant from Washington University where I teach. So that's been really, really helpful. And otherwise, it's been on our own dime.
Hmm. Well, I want to ask you one more question. It's been fascinating to talk about all this. And that is often the case, of course, right? There's so much of work has to be funded on your own, especially with this kind of work. Does that seem like a drawback to touch on that one more time? Or is that what enables the project to be free? You know, and when I talk to different artists about funding, often at the end of the interviews about whatever it is, sometimes the funding allows lack of funding, for lack of a better word, allows the project to do whatever it wants to do or needs to do, whereas sometimes funding can be constrictive or the need for sales. Do either of those apply? Are you happy with where it's at? Does that make sense for it to be funded and self-funded and with grants? Is that the ideal scenario?
Yeah, I think it is. The grant that I received through the university doesn't have the kind of restrictions that some other types of more private grants might have. So it's been helpful just to kind of pursue the project as we desire to. Of course, it would be nice to have additional funding because as soon as we move to other locations, just the travel and shipping and all of that will might become prohibitive for us to try and fund on our own. Yeah, it's a dilemma for sure.
And I'd like to ask you one more question. What is it that you're reading now? I'm always curious what people are reading.
Well, I'm reading a lot of things that are tied to the book that we talked about, the Unbound book, the book of Eternal Return. So I've been reading Lucretius on the nature of things, which has been fascinating. One of the things we didn't get to talk about, but that I'm really interested in is the accidental or the incidental is kind of marginal. So Lucretius talks about atomism or atoms and matter, physical matter, and the swerve, basically, the Kleinemann. I've been reading William Kentridge's Six Drawing Lessons, also related to the project, his discussion about the black hole as a metaphor for death and what traces we leave behind has been really important part of my thinking. I've been reading Hans Joost Fry's book, Interruptions, about the fragment. Because every story or every history is incomplete or a fragment. And so that's also part of this project of these Unbound pages.
So true. I want to thank you so much, Lisa, for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.